Time to take a look at the wonderful world of wildlife. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller. Really pleased to have you listening in. If you have a question, join us at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Scott, great to have you back.
Well, it's great to be back, Larry. I remember the last time we were on, we were sweating a bit and eating cheese at the State Fair.
Yes, that's right.
Broadcasting from the tent, so that seems like a long time ago. But
it does seem like a long time ago, and I tell you what, now we're going into one of those times of the year. It's just really a beautiful time and a fun time of the year for those interested in wildlife.
Yes, and I personally was so happy to see the weather change last night. Mm-hmm. It's uncanny how the first day of classes, it can invariably be 90 and humid. The first 90 we've had in Madison all season, and it was hot on campus. But it's nice now, and it does lead us into fall, and fall's a terrific time for wildlife activities, whether you're a hunter, a non-hunter, or whatever. There's just all sorts of things to do out there.
And you were telling me before the show that the nut crop and the berry crop is really something this year.
Well, the last roughly 2 weeks I've been in northern Wisconsin most of the time doing a series of landowner wildlife workshops around particularly the northeastern counties and talking to landowners and driving around a bit, and there are a couple striking things up there, and it seems to be the same case here. It is an excellent mast crop, the so-called both hard mast, the nuts, and soft mast like choke cherries and black cherries and things like that. So it, in a way, it kind of makes up for a lousy spring in terms of cold and wet and the detrimental impacts on wildlife of that. But now all of a sudden we're headed into fall when these animals need food resources, and the hazel bushes are just loaded with nuts. There are acorns. So we were at Kemp Station, and my wife was trying to read a book in the yard there while I was getting ready for a workshop, but twice she got clonked on the head by a big red oak acorn that came down from about 50 feet. And so it's in terms of food resources, it'll be a really good thing.
Well, lots of callers online, so let's go to the phones. John and Madison, you are up. Hi, John.
Hey, Larry. Question for Scott here. I live in Madison, Wisconsin, and I own a tree care company, and three or four times a year my crew will encounter flying squirrels. And I'm wondering if you could speak to flying squirrel status in the state, life cycle, habits, anything that you've got on those little critters for us.
Well, okay, John, I'll try and give you the Reader's Digest version here rather than launching into a long discussion, but we have flying squirrels are more abundant than most people realize. They're entirely nocturnal, so it's uncommon for people to see them out and about unless you're watching them come to a bird feeder at night, or if you discover them incidentally while cutting firewood or a tree, or as in your case with a tree service. There are two species, the southern flying squirrel, which is a smallish one, a little bigger than a chipmunk, and the northern flying squirrel, about twice that size, and you can tell them apart by size if you have them in hand, but the hairs on the belly of the southern flying squirrels are all bright white. There's no gray on the inner part, so that's the way you tell them apart. The southern flying squirrel has seemingly extended its range further north and extends all the way to Lake Superior now, and perhaps that's been at the detriment of the larger northern flying squirrel, because we haven't heard much about them in recent years. But we have a grad student working on flying squirrels as we speak. In fact, I saw her yesterday. She was headed back to Oneida County to track radio-equipped flying squirrels all night last night. So she's learning a lot about flying squirrel behavior and interactions with different forestry practices, and if they can find some northerns, and I guess they have some on one site, interactions between the two species. So anyway, behaviorally, or how they spend their year, very similar to a gray squirrel in terms of a couple of litters of young, one in early spring, one usually in midsummer, at least for the southern flying squirrels. They're particularly prone to inhabit hollow trees and tree cavities, or sometimes nest boxes. And if they're disrupted during tree care, usually, you know, assuming they're not injured or you can rouse them out of the tree before it's cut, they'll simply move to another den site. If they have the opportunity and they have young, they'll move the young like a female gray squirrel will, but there may be occasions where you might knock down a tree and not knowing that they're in there. And then as the tree shatters on impact, all of a sudden there's young ones, and what happened to mom? That may be a bit of a problem, but it's also a great segue into something else I hope we're going to talk about in the next hour, which is what to do with orphan young animals. Well, we can lead into that, and I'd like to talk a little bit about some local rehab centers. But there are places. You're here in Madison, so the one in hand is the Four Lakes Wildlife Center, which is affiliated with the Dane County Humane Society. There are many such rehab centers, wildlife rehab centers, scattered around the state, and those would be one of your first lines of defense if you came up with a litter of young flying squirrels or anything else out of a tree cavity. And either the parent was obviously killed or driven off, then you can contact folks like the volunteers at Four Lakes, and that's a repository for them. And, you know, typically these things are, like gray squirrels, are seed and nut eaters, and they frequent bird feeders, love sunflower seeds. And the last thing I'll say about them is that among our mammals here in Wisconsin, I'd have to say that the flying squirrels are... It's not a very objective term, but I'd say they're the cutest little critters out there.
they are.
They are really pretty. They have
big
huge
eyes.
Dark eyes, and their fur is incredibly soft and very luxurious. And they've got that big, flat, rudder-like tail for gliding. They can't fly, by the way, only glide. And hopefully, John, that's about more than you ever hope to know about flying squirrels.
And they're not endangered. So if we find them, we typically pull off the job when we encounter them just to kind of give them some breathing room. But any endangered issues I have to worry about?
No, not at all.
No.
They're
lots
really
of them, Madison.
They're really quite common.
And I should mention, you mentioned the call center, the Four Lakes, which is a wildlife society, which is a great a place to take an animal here. If you're wondering where to go, and this kind of relates to an earlier program of a few days back, Ann Bauer from the DNR reminds us that the DNR call center has in Madison has live people, dedicated, well-trained, answering questions, assisting and facilitating anything from animals to registrations and licenses for callers. They're open from 7 in the morning till 10 at night, 7 days a week, including a Memorial Day and the 4th of July, Labor Day, and so forth. And there is a toll-free number from anywhere in the state, any time of the day you could get it. It's 1-888-WDNR-INFO. That would be the 1-888-WDNR-INFO, or it's 888, the numbers are 936-7463, 936-7463. And they're there pretty much 24 hours a day, so...
That's also a good linkage because the DNR does license individual wildlife rehabbers around the state. There are many of them. The Wisconsin Wildlife Rehabilitators Association has a website. So sometimes checking with the DNR, going to the website, will also find rehabilitators which will take care of or who will take care of orphaned, injured, or abandoned wildlife. The Four Lakes Center that I mentioned, for example, last year, one of my undergrad students is involved there as a volunteer, and that's how I happened to have come by the information. But just as an example, they alone treated 950 animals.
Wow.
Last year. So, you know, there are lots of cases where people are certainly sympathetic and concerned about the well-being of individual animals, and there are many such places that must add up into the tens of thousands of animals that are cared for and hopefully reintroduced into the wild. She mentioned in particular a couple of recent cases with snapping turtles that had been hit, large turtles that had been cracked by, in one case, a boat propeller, sometimes by a car, and they have a vet who actually does the shell repair for them as a free service. Many vets volunteer their time that way, and these turtles were fixed up and... Well, I don't know about fine, but they were
they're
good to go, and they have lots of interesting cases. So if folks run into something like that, there are places out there who will take the animals, and these places also need help in terms of volunteers, financial support, and all sorts of other things. So there you have it.
There you have it. And, John, thanks again. Deb in Neillsville, we'll give you a chance now. Deb, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have bats that I need to get rid of in my attic.
Mm-hmm.
I'm having a difficult time finding somebody to come out to eradicate them for me. And I've looked on the web, on the internet,
mm-hmm.
and I've called a couple of places, but I don't feel like spending $500 to $2,000 to have it taken care of. I live in Clark County.
I know Neillsville well.
Okay. Do you know somebody in the area that I can call?
No, but I have some listings of folks back in my office.
Okay.
And you can also go to the Bat Conservation International website, and they list from around the country, including Wisconsin, folks that I don't think there's any necessarily any certification process, but folks that Bat Conservation International sanctions or approves of in terms of the way they handle bat problems.
Right.
So you might try the Bat Conservation International website, and you might try also through the DNR office locally or directly.
I called them, and that wasn't well. I do have a call into the Black River Falls.
Well, what I was going to suggest was that they can put you in touch with folks in the Wisconsin Trappers Association, and the trappers have banded together, and they publish an annual booklet with licensed and skilled and qualified trappers who do animal control work, and some of them do dabble in bat work. You mentioned the cost involved, and you also used the term eradication, and I need to point out that the issue in bat control is not one of spraying, poisoning, or trapping, or otherwise eradicating the bats in that sense. It's a matter of preventing their access, essentially what we call bat-proofing the structure. So the bats are allowed to get out but can't get back in, and that's the long-term solution, not only to benefit you, the homeowner, but also so that no bats are actually harmed mm-hmm. in the process. And that's why it can be expensive. If it's an older home where perhaps as much as sometimes even a new roof might be necessary, and that can get mighty costly.
Yeah, mighty costly.
We are getting a new roof, and one of the guys that I called that does do the removal of the bats
mm-hmm.
said, well, you need to have us come out first to plug up all the holes before you get a new roof.
Well, that's not exactly true. If you plug up the holes, you simply trap the bats inside.
Right.
What has to be done is that the holes, some of the minor holes might be plugged initially, but the major access or egress points are treated with essentially a one-way device called a bat excluder, and those can be fabricated to meet the needs, or there are commercial ones. It's essentially just a one-way door, and it allows the bats to go out on a warm evening like last night and feed, but they can't get back in.
Okay.
And once that's been used for four or five suitable nights, the bats are presumably all on the outside, can't get back on the inside. At that point, the holes can be sealed, the roof can be repaired or replaced, and you're good to go, and the bats have gone somewhere else.
Yeah, they're somewhere else. So think about that, and thank you very much for calling. I'll give you that DNR info 888 number. It was 888-936-7463 is that other number that we talked about, too. So good luck to you, Deb, and thank you very much for calling. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, and Julie in Trempealeau County is up next, so let's go to Julie. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Scott. Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about a sound I heard one evening about a week and a half ago. This was about 12:30 in the morning. It was coming from about 300 to 400 yards away, I'm guessing. It was a loud whoop, and then it would wait for about 30 seconds, and I'd hear it again, and I probably heard it maybe 10 times. I haven't heard it since. Question about what it would be.
Well, what do you think, Scott? Owl, maybe?
Could be. I guess, we chronically struggle with these kinds of calls,
yeah.
Larry, in terms of not being able to hear the sound, but rather the interpretation of the sound, and that sometimes makes it tricky. But I guess what this points up to me is we should reinstitute our attempt to play half a dozen wildlife sounds or calls with each program to try and help the listeners figure out what these things are. Now, that kind of whoop rings a bell with me, but it's not registering as to what it might be. So
stay listening, know, Julie. That might come.
The periodic whoop in the night might stimulate some of our many thousands of highly skilled naturalist listeners to bail us out on this one. So bear with us. It's early in the program. I think we'll probably get some possibilities for you.
Oh, we'll probably get a lot. We'll get lots of them. Thanks, Julie. Jim in Kewaunee County, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Good morning.
Morning.
The proof of the pudding is in the eating. I pointed that out to you about a year ago. But the reason I'm calling is a month ago, people were talking about red fox, and I haven't seen one for years.
Mm-hmm.
And I recalled an instance that happened to me about 1938. I was pheasant hunting and went into a woods when I heard hounds howling. And this was a woods, about a 40-acre woods running along the shore of Lake Michigan. And so I sat down to see. They're coming toward me. I sat down on a dead fall to see what I could see. Mm-hmm. When, sure enough, here comes a little red fox. And he's not racing. He's trotting at a pretty good clip. He's not 25 feet away from me, running parallel to the lake, headed south. He runs probably 20 feet past me and stops, looks back at where the hounds are howling, makes a right turn. Now he's headed west. He runs about 50 feet to the west, stops again, listens to ascertain where the hounds are, and takes off north. So at the time these hounds are coming south, he's 50 feet west of them heading north.
pretty good idea, it sounds to me.
Oh, that's a they're is smart the right word for a fox?
Well,
you hear
wary,
smart like a
wary, capable, is smart in the sense of smart like a fox, but not necessarily smart like a human. But in terms of the observation that haven't seen one for a while, you know, they're not the most common animal to see. I've seen a couple of live ones cross the road in just the last month or so, and had the opportunity to pick up, although I didn't because I was leading a caravan on a field tour, and there was just a really dandy specimen of a youngster killed on the side of Highway 47 up near Rhinelander. I was going to snag that for the museum collection, but by the time I came back, it was gone. But they certainly are out there, but there are interactions with coyotes that are problematic for fox and a variety of other issues. So their abundance is open to some debate, but they're certainly out there.
Yeah. Thanks, Jim, for calling. Appreciate it. Owen in Cornucopia, your turn. Hi, Owen.
Hi. Thanks a lot for taking my call.
Sure.
In reference to this last caller, actually up here I see quite a few red fox.
Well,
good.
At any rate,
good.
Hunters in Wisconsin, they're allowed to use radio transmitters on dogs for bear hunting.
Mm-hmm.
And they're allowed, apparently, to practice a week ahead of time. It just seems to me a little unfortunate for the bear that they're, you know, have technology working against them. Is that humane, do you feel, or is it detrimental to the bear population in Wisconsin?
I don't think it may be detrimental to individual bears that are have a pack of hounds in hot pursuit, but in terms of the population, it's not. That's a closely regulated situation in terms of the number of harvest permits issued. Bear season actually opened today.
Today, yeah.
And it alternates, actually. Bears are hunted primarily with two techniques, either the proponents of baiting, who put out all manner of strange foodstuffs to attempt to attract bears to a pile of food when they're harvested, or the hound hunters who vigorously pursue them with the hounds and then eventually bring them to a tree or whatnot where they may or may not be harvested. The humane issue for the bears probably doesn't enter into it too much unless you want to consider the stress or strain that's put on them as they're pursued or the actual harvesting practice. But the fact that the dogs may be equipped with high technology, or that the hunters between vehicles are using all sorts of cell phones or two-way radios or GPS units or assorted other things, that's kind of a sign of the times. Some hunters embrace the new technology, and some hunters look at it and go back to Leopold's famous quote that the quality of the hunting experience is inversely proportional to the amount of gadgetry used, or something to that effect. In other words, the more technical and complicated it becomes, the less it's an elemental experience in the hunt. Now, everybody has their own personal viewpoints on that. So if, you know, some people would say that the hound hunting in and of itself is an issue. Some would say that it only becomes an issue when they're starting to use high technology gadgetry. So there's a wide spectrum of opinions when it comes to bear hunting, but there are certainly people who take advantage of what is legally usable, and these things are legal tools to assist in the harvest of bears. Now, in terms of the population, not too worried about that situation for a couple reasons. Number one, you may have seen some publicity just a few weeks ago issued as a result of a research project here on campus that after 1 year of information suggests that there could be perhaps twice as many bears, maybe even more, bears in the state than the DNR population estimates had suggested. And there's another year of that study forthcoming to hopefully validate that particular numeric claim or scale it back. If that's the case, then the harvest permits that have been issued based on a bear population that's perhaps much smaller than reality is in fact a very conservative harvest, and the bear population is doing very, very well. This year, for example, there were 4,660 harvest permits issued, and last year, with a few less permits, there were about 2,800 bears killed.
About now, every other hunter gets one, roughly.
Yeah, but there's a tremendous number of people applying for the permits who don't get a permit. So there's great demand for it. And in some cases, it takes, I think, 7 to 10 years in a given management unit before you actually successfully get a harvest permit. So there's a long time between opportunities for an individual hunter to harvest a bear. But the point being, with a kill of less than 3,000, even if the DNR's conservative population estimate of maybe 15,000 is correct, it's still well within the capabilities of the bear population to sustain itself. And if the population's actually twice that or more, then it's a non-issue. So,
All right.
You know, different opinions.
Thank you, Owen, for calling. Appreciate it. Mark and Racine will give you a chance now. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Scott. Hi, Larry.
Hi.
Hello.
I'm kind of interested in population dynamics, and I've watched them over the course of years. Something I think that really there should be ongoing study on is evolutionary change in crickets. In the mid-80s, I thought crickets were on the ropes. European earwigs had come in and displaced them from their habitats. Drier summers have been better for crickets now, but I think there's going to be a lot of adaption and change in cricket populations as a result. That's a comment. A couple of questions I have is, through much of my life in Racine, up until, I would say the late 70s, you very seldom saw a crow in Racine. Then for quite a number of years, there were a lot of crows in Racine, and now you don't see them very often anymore. I was wondering if that's due to habitat changes or food fluctuations, if you might happen to know.
Well, early on, as neighborhoods were maturing and cities were enlarging, crows took advantage of the situation and moved in from rural habitats to take up residence in maturing neighborhoods that had trees that provided them with necessary roost sites and shelter. And they became very abundant in urban areas, and there was a lot of concern over crows in terms of perhaps depredating on songbirds, getting into trash bags, making noise, all sorts of problems and issues. Either because of, in some cases, aggressive control programs to eliminate roosts or drive them out of those areas. That's been the case in some areas. There's also been some concern that a general decline in crow numbers has been a result of their recent susceptibility to West Nile virus, and they being kind of the bellwether bird as far as West Nile virus is concerned, and that may also be part of the explanation for changes in observations.
So interesting. Thank you very much for calling. Bryce, or Kurt in New London, I believe, is up next. Kurt, hello to you.
Hello. I'm here, yeah. My question is to Scott, what happened to all the bullheads and frogs under navigable water?
Tell you, I had a chance to talk to Bill Volkert of the DNR, And he was on the show on Labor Day, as a matter of fact. And Bill said the frog population in many areas of the state has really exploded and gotten huge, partly as a result of the fact that we had all that rain in the spring, and the rain created whole potholes and so forth for additional frogs and spread out the chance for frogs to actually populate and recreate and so forth. So I think they were actually up this year.
Well, I think in some cases, Larry, we talked earlier about the detrimental impacts or lack thereof relative to the spring flooding and heavy rains. But I think now the consensus is that it was a real boom to amphibian populations. And
yeah.
You only have to go to the other end of campus. There's a what became a little pond between the large parking area, Lot 60 and University Bay, had, when I took our College for Kids classes down there, the greatest, densest population of leopard frogs I've ever seen. There were thousands of them. The kids would go into the grass, and the frogs were like popcorn. They were everywhere. And since then, as I've traveled around a bit, it seems like frog populations seem to be enjoying a good year. I think the question Kurt has here, I suspect, deals with some concerns I've heard over whether on navigable waters there are impacts on frogs, either by boat motors, snowmobiles on the ice, or other mechanical contrivances of humans that disturb or cause problems for the frogs on the bottom of these navigable waters.
Okay.
Either during the winter when they're hibernating or at other times. And I've done a little checking on that since I heard that theory espoused this summer, and I can't find any herpetologists who subscribe to it. But regardless of whether there's any impact in normal years, this seems to be, if you're a frog, this is the year of the frog.
And what about bullheads?
I have no idea.
No idea there.
Okay. No idea about bull. Okay. My experience with bullheads is that you can keep a bullhead alive in a muddy bucket of water for a lot longer than any other fish, and they're pretty darn durable.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling, Kurt. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. And you can also email us at talk@WPR.org. Give us a call and send us an email. We'll get you on the air. And Pat and Rhinelander's up next, so let's go to Pat. Hi, Pat.
How you doing?
Good.
I have a question about deer control. I live up in the upper northeast, and because of CWD, we have half of the state, or all of the state, hunting in half of the state's area. I have hunted for 5 years now and have seen one buck that is worth shooting.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is, are we going to do anything about the limitations? Are we going to put limitations on these like Pennsylvania did, to where it's a 6-point or better? Because, to be honest, it irritates the heck out of me when I go to a chicken station or I go to get gas, and here's a guy from Madison or Milwaukee, and he's proud as heck that he got himself a buck, and it turns out to be a fork.
Well, this is sort of, Pat, like the discussion we just had about different attitudes toward techniques of bear hunting, but you know, a trophy deer is often in the eyes of the beholder, and while most hunters would probably subscribe to the notion that a 2.5-year-older animal that's got at least a reasonably heavy 8-point rack and a pretty good spread, well, that's a trophy. But for a first-time kid out hunting, a doe fawn is a trophy. And for hunters who maybe aren't too successful or have trouble getting back in the woods or haven't killed a deer for a few years, then that little fork might be a real trophy. And it's meat one way or the other. So I think one of the concerns that at least I have as far as deer hunting, and I've been a deer hunter for quite a long time along with Larry, is that we not get too caught up, or I hope that hunters don't get too tangled up in the notion that the only deer that should be shot is the perception of a large racked buck, because that's going to create all sorts of havoc with deer management and all sorts of havoc with the perception of non-hunters in terms of what we're out there doing or trying to accomplish. I don't quite understand your your comment about all the state hunting and half the state, or half the state hunting and all the state, or whatever that was, the chronic wasting disease management zone has been expanded to include a big chunk of the extreme southern two or three tiers of counties, but the rest of the state remains relatively unaffected by that. The North Woods, since that's where you hunt, the northern counties, I don't know, maybe a dozen or 15 counties will actually be the focus of CWD surveillance this year. So I'd put in a plug for hunters in Pat's area, all around Rhinelander, that the DNR will be actively seeking, I think it's 500 samples of brain tissue to survey for CWD in the Northwoods this coming season. And we certainly need to all keep our fingers crossed that, like the other areas they've checked outside of the management zone, they've not found it. But it was released about a week ago that the first case of CWD was found in Michigan, in the lower peninsula, not too far from the Lake Michigan shoreline in Michigan, on a deer farm. So Michigan's kind of agitated, and I had a call from one of their biologists this morning asking to use some of our extension literature on CWD. So there's still the fear that it could turn up somewhere else, and it is what it is, and we're stuck with those regulations. But overall, despite concerns about some areas that may not have as many deer as others, the population's in really good shape. There are some counties in the north central area where some of the restrictions on hunting have been, or the restricted regulations like earn a buck and so forth, have been relaxed or lifted this year because the population was reduced by last year's winter conditions. But overall, they're still thinking we're headed into the fall hunting season with 1.5 to 1.7 million deer. It opens up, a week from Saturday on the 13th, and it should be another darn good season. And there you have it.
All right. Pat, thank you.
I guess if I had one more question, could I get a reply to that?
Go ahead.
You talk about how we're trying to manage does, and that if we ended up putting a regulation on an antler size, allowing these little bucks to grow up to be bigger bucks, that would also push people to take the does. I have 30 does in my yard.
That's correct.
Every day. And I haven't seen a buck in 2 years.
Well, it seems to be working in Pennsylvania, as you alluded to, and certainly in Wisconsin. There are many groups, folks working either formally within the confines of the Quality Deer Management Association or simply on their own with hunting groups, who have implemented their own voluntary restrictions that, you know, either the deer has to be a fork or better, or it has to be a spread outside the ears. And, you know, it can be a voluntary thing. It can be something groups of landowners get together to do. Whether or not hunters overall in Wisconsin would support an antler restriction statewide, I have no idea. But I think it would be a tough interesting discussion and potentially a tough sell. But certainly individuals, growing a trophy buck in Wisconsin isn't particularly complicated or rocket science. If you let the animal live to be 2.5 or older, it's going to be a pretty nice buck. The fact that somebody else on the neighboring property may have a different viewpoint and shoot it before it gets to be 2.5, well, that's a biopolitical issue or an issue in neighborly cooperation, but it happens, and that's the way it is.
Pat, thank you for calling. I want to give some others a chance to get on here. By the way, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Give us a call. Rick in Cambridge is up next. Rick, hello.
Hello, good afternoon, or good morning, as the case may be. My question is for Scott in regard to the new regulations this year about the CWD areas down south here, opening the season up to use of rifle as well as shotgun.
Mm-hmm.
I personally have found it at least a hot topic of discussion among all the hunters that I know, and we're kind of concerned about what we feel is the wisdom of opening that up down in this more dense populated area with much more people, much more buildings, highways, traffic, and everything else, and we'd like to get your opinion on it.
Well, I'm actually surprised, Rick, that it didn't stir up more dialogue and conversation than it did. I thought it would be one of the major issues in the proposed regulations package, but at the time this was all going through the various hearings and the legislature and so forth for acceptance, it was kind of a non-issue. Some of my colleagues have been talking about it since, But there have been several studies circulating, particularly one from Pennsylvania, and there was a kind of a big expose on this in the North American Hunter magazine just last month that talked about the so-called safety issue. And there was considerable evidence that the safety issue is a non-issue, that the issue of slugs in terms of how they carry and how they bounce off the ground and tumble and ricochet and so forth suggests that that's not the argument that people might be making. My own opinion, since you asked for it, is I am just tickled pink that I can carry my rifle in shotgun areas. Now, whether I just never became particularly proficient or not, I found shooting slugs to be just a little more effective for me than throwing large rocks. whereas with my rifle that I feel very good about, and I've gone through the DNR sharpshooter training, and
I feel exactly the same way. I mean, I know many of us over the years that we always kind of curse out the old shotgun use.
God,
if I only had my rifle.
Some people are very good.
It makes people feel very good that way. But I just was curious about your opinion in regards to the safety aspect.
I don't think it's going to prove. Now, I God forbid there's some sort of an incident with a rifle, yeah, and that people immediately, if it hadn't been a rifle, this accident wouldn't have happened. But hopefully nothing like that will occur. And, you know, if it does, I don't think it's really related to the regulations change, because those accidents could occur, or a different type of accident could occur with a shotgun. But I personally think it's going to make hunters more efficient, and I think it will help in the DNR's overall concern that more deer would be harvested. I can just think, hunting in shotgun areas, I've had more than one occasion, multiple occasions, where I would see a deer that I was very confident I could have killed efficiently and quickly with my rifle that I couldn't even fire at with the shotgun.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to change the whole dynamic of the hunting situation. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I hunt with some folks who are very, very skilled with their shotguns and harvest deer that, boy, I couldn't have done that. So it's going to take a little bit of a transition period here. But my prediction is in 2 or 3 or 4 years, assuming things stay the way they are, that people will have kind of forgotten that shotguns were ever required in some of these areas.
Yeah, and it's open statewide now to rifle. Is that correct?
That's my impression. Yeah. Well, no, I don't. I think there may still be shotgun areas outside the CWD management areas. I think this was a CWD-related change.
Okay. All right. Rick, thank you very much. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have a wildlife question, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Scott Craven. Joe in De Pere is up next with a question. And Joe, on to you. Thanks for calling.
You're welcome. In reference to the caller that called earlier about foxes in Kewaunee, near Kewaunee, we play golf at a golf course in the Manitowoc Brown County line.
Mm-hmm.
And I was playing back in June. I hit my ball into the sand trap, and I thought a couple of geese walked out of the sand trap, and as they got closer, I found out they were foxes.
Uh-huh.
Oh, that's interesting. There's two of them. I've never seen two before, and I played a couple of holes later, and I saw those same two foxes down by one of the tees, and out of the woods comes their mother. And it was no doubt, based on the size and time of year, that it had to be a mother and two little ones.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, how many kits do they have? And what do they eat? Hopefully, geese.
Well, in northern climes, one of the major predators on goose nests is Arctic fox. So I assume our red fox, given the opportunity, would certainly take a goose egg out of a nest. And they might take a gosling if they got the chance before they grew up very well. But parent geese are pretty darn protective of their goslings. And I think a fox would take a real beating from mother or father goose if it tried to get into the goslings once they'd left the nest and grown a little bit. So they may take an occasional goose for you, Joe, but I think our urban goose problem is not, or the golf course goose problem is not going to be solved by the local fox family. But in answer to your question about the number of pups, they're members of the dog family, so litter sizes are a little larger than for the average dog, but I think you can get fox litters up to 8, 10, 12, although it's unusual for that many pups to survive or make it. And if they're not eating geese, their primary food materials would be small field rodents.
Mice.
Reptiles, amphibians, yeah, different mice, whatever they can get a hold of and catch. And maybe in some cases even an occasional fruit or vegetable material. But mostly small mammals, small birds, snakes, frogs, things like that.
All well, right. that would explain what I saw as I watched these three foxes. The mother walked into the pond and was promptly chased out by Mother Goose.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
Yeah, I'm hoping to hear gophers on there, too. But
well, they'd take a gopher, too.
Oh, they would certainly eat ground squirrels and so forth if they get a hold of them.
Thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Bob in Lebanon next. Hi, Bob.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have some unwanted woodchucks that are starting to make holes around my barn, and now I just find one up against the house.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering how, if you had any recommendations of saying I don't want you here anymore, and I don't really want to kill them if I can help it. But.
Well, you can certainly post signs, Bob, that say woodchucks not welcome, but I think they'll ignore them.
Yeah.
Larry happens to be an expert on woodchuck removal on his own property, and he's been very successful with live traps in terms of baiting and trapping them and then removing them.
What would you use as a bait?
Larry, what's your best bait?
Well, I've frankly, any vegetables. I put some carrots out there. You could put some peanut butter and on some celery. You can do just pretty much anything, whatever's out there in a live trap. I've trapped 9 off my backyard, and my backyard is only 50 feet wide and about 50 long. So
you put it close to the hole then?
I didn't have any holes. They were just coming in and eating out of my garden.
Oh.
If you see where that, if you know where their burrows are, or you know where they have a trail that leads to the garden, or a trail that goes under a fence panel, then that's the best place to put the trap. And as Larry says, any green vegetable or whatever they're eating, be it green beans or broccoli right. or something like that, sliced carrot coins, a sliced apple works very well. Keep the bait fresh and position the trap well, and you'll catch them. And then since you don't want to injure them, if you can find, you know, if your cousin down the road's got a farm and they're out of town for a week, that'd be a really good place to put them. And if the trapping wears thin, or if that's just not doing the job for you, then although there are protected species in Wisconsin, there's a landowner exclusion clause that allows you to hunt, trap, or control them year-round on your own property. So they could be shot. That's an approach some people take. Or there are also fumigation bombs or things that look like big firecrackers that your garden center or co-op may carry. And you simply put a fuse in this cardboard cylinder, ignite it, put it down the burrow, and then cover the burrow, and then presumably the combustion gases kill the animal in the burrow. And that can work too, although don't do that if the burrow is up against the house, because it's possible that the fumes may leak into the foundation or somehow get into your living space.
In another property that I know about, it was an old farmhouse, and the animals, the woodchucks, had actually somehow they'd burrowed under, and they'd actually gotten up into the wall. So
that's no good.
That is no good.
No good. No good. Bad.
No good at all. And in that case, the owners resorted to because they were in the country, resorted to 12-gauge shotguns for eliminating. So there you have it, Bob. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Rick in Portage County, it's your turn. Hi, Rick.
Hi, thanks. I have a question concerning, I grouse hunt with my dogs up in Forest in Florence County,
mm-hmm.
and all that. I'm not really concerned about it, but I wonder if you're aware of any interaction between wolves and grouse dogs or up dogs when you're, you know, pursuing upland game in that part of the state.
Well, I think the interaction, Rick, that most hunters are concerned about is that the wolf eats the dog. And,
yeah, exactly.
And that's the interaction people are worried about, and it has happened. I think I don't have the numbers here in front of me, but I'll go out on a limb and say my recollection was 17 dogs killed last year, and I think it's usually in the neighborhood of the teens.
In Wisconsin?
In Wisconsin, by wolves. And, you know, wolves have become more abundant and more widespread than perhaps we thought they were. And there's a lot of contentiousness associated with wolf numbers and wolf presence in the North Woods. And one of the sources of friction is the fact that they do kill dogs. Now, more often, it's dogs that are running freely, like hound packs and so forth, bear dogs that are being trained or hunting bears, than a flushing dog or a pointer that you've got fairly close or maybe have a control collar on while you're actually walking along behind it. But it has happened, and it's something you need to take into consideration. Not a high risk, but it could happen. And my advice would be that you take a little time on the DNR website or contact the wolf folks up in one of the northern offices like Park Falls and see where your hunting spot is in relation to known pack territories. And some of the packs are a little more notorious in this behavior than others. In fact, there are sometimes warnings or alerts put out to hunters that the XYZ pack or whatever the name happens to be has been particularly problematic, and then you would decide on your hunting plan accordingly. So
that's great information. I'm wondering if I could ask one more quick question about fishers in Portage County.
That's what we're here for.
Oh, great. I used to spend a lot of time in the Suwamish and up in the Cable area and Clam Lake, where I believe they reinstituted fishers up there.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the, I'm thinking, late 70s it probably was. That's when I was up there anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And now we've got them down here in Portage County. And have they come all that way in those decades, or were they put in, or
no, they've come all that way.
Is that right? Wow.
Fishers and martens, two members of the weasel family, were both restored in the North Woods after being extirpated from their range. And fishers really took off. They just did really well. The martens have not. But they did very well in terms of numbers, and they did very well in terms of distributing themselves across the landscape, to the point that we've even seen them occasionally in southern Wisconsin. A wildlife manager colleague of mine got a terrific picture of a fisher sitting in an aspen tree out in Governor Dodge State Park in Iowa County in southern Wisconsin. So they have occupied a big chunk of the state on their own, but it's my impression, what I hear from the folks who work with them, is that the population level, although their distribution is greater than it and continues perhaps to expand, the density of fishers after that initial burst of population explosion has begun to tail off a little bit. But they're still quite abundant and frequently seen.
Well, terrific. Thanks a bunch, you guys.
Okay.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Rick, for calling. Let's go to Linda in Blaine next. Hi, Linda.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
What a great program.
Thank you.
I have two questions for you. The first is about cougars in Wisconsin. I'm wondering when the DNR would be interested in reintroduction of cougars. I'm from other states, or I've lived in other states, and would love to see cougars in Wisconsin again. My second question has to do with hunting. We're a landowner on a lake, and we have a 100-foot of frontage, and most people do on this lake. I've been surprised that hunters are able to hunt, hunt goose or even bear on their property. And I'm wondering, is the DNR going to come up with a high density where populations are, where it's not allowed? I'm sometimes even nervous to go out on my deck, and I'll take the answers offline. Thanks so much.
So, by the way, you're saying that they're hunting from their 100-foot property?
Yes.
Shooting out into the lake and even shooting at bears on their property?
Baiting bears and everything.
Oh. Well, I think more an issue there than the hunting seasons or those considerations are the regulations that deal with firearms discharge in proximity to a building.
Yeah.
And that's more the issue that you could hang your hat on if you objected to this. I don't think the firearms regulations are waived because it's your building, is it, Larry? Is that true?
Can you
sit on your deck and plink at pop cans with a .22? I'm not sure about that. Maybe a warden will give us a call. But nevertheless, there are restrictions on for hunters, firearms discharge in terms of proximity to a building, and there are also local ordinances that deal with firearms discharge within an ordinance, township, community, or what have you. the notion that they may be hunting waterfowl in front of their property. If I were far enough from my cabin up in Price County and there was a good duck flight on the pond, I'd probably be out there with the decoys. So, you know, that's an issue where people are probably shooting out toward the lake or onto the wetland, and I don't think that's much of a safety concern. It may be an annoyance to other people, but not a safety concern and not illegal as far as duck hunting is concerned. So you might just check with local ordinances as far as that issue is concerned. As far as the cougar issue, I think it's pretty well accepted now that there are cougars in Wisconsin. The sightings are fairly regular. The DNR and other interested parties have established a cougar working group or a task force of interested biologists working on consolidating sightings and a management plan and response to cougar sightings and cougar issues and so forth. I'd be really surprised, however, if there was any dialogue about intentionally moving cougars from the Dakotas or some other population source back into Wisconsin. If they're here, they're going to get here on their own, and they're going to grow a population on their own rather than being augmented by stalking.
And thanks for calling. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest here on the Ideas Network. Talking the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Actually, we can talk about wildlife outside Wisconsin, too, if you want to join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. And lots of people online, so let's go to Pete in Krakow first. Pete, hello.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
Well, I've read an article recently in a Wyoming Wildlife magazine. It's a publication from the Wyoming Game and Fish Department, and they talk about deer mice, and I guess this is pretty much a yes or no question whether or not deer mice live in Wisconsin. There are a lot of similarities other than altitude between the Wyoming forest and Wisconsin forest, and my concern about these deer mice is that they are prone to carry a disease known as hantavirus.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be fatal to humans.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I have seen mice in Wisconsin that look very similar to these pictures. So I guess a little input from you would
help. All
well,
right.
I think we can clear this up, Pete. And if we have any confusion over it, the editor of Wyoming Wildlife, Chris Madsen, is an old grad school office buddy from UW-Madison here, so we can get right to the root of the problem. We certainly do have deer mice here. We actually have two subspecies of deer mice and another one called the white-footed mouse, all of which look pretty much the same. If there were any scientific names in that article, they're all in the genus Paramiscus, and they all look pretty much the same. The difference between these wild field mice, as they're called, both the white-footed and the deer mouse, between that and a house mouse is the white belly, white feet, and the lower part of their tail is white. They're very common all over Wisconsin, and the three subspecies or species are very difficult to tell apart. But you're right. The short answer to your question is we do have deer mice. Whether they're the exact same subspecies as found in Wyoming is up for grabs, but it doesn't matter. The issue of hantavirus involvement is a concern here as well as in the desert southwest. It was actually discovered at the intersection between Colorado, New Mexico, and whatever those other states are, the so-called Four Corners area. Mm-hmm. So if you see it described as Four Corners disease or hantavirus, it's the same thing.
Right. Is there potential? Has there been any tracking of that virus in Wisconsin?
Yeah, there's been some concern about it, and I think it's been identified here in Wisconsin, but it hasn't garnered a huge amount of attention lately because we've had other disease issues like West Nile and CWD that have overshadowed it. But I think it is still a concern. Mm. I just can't tell you what the current situation is.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Joan in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Joan.
Hi. Couldn't believe our eyes. We were coming down the road. I was up in the UP in the Hiawatha National Park canoeing. And maybe 200, 250 feet in front of us, crossing the road really fast, was this cougar.
Mm-hmm.
And it's no mistaking what it was. Neighbors of my brothers that live up there year-round said they've seen them, but we poo-pooed the thought. But I just wanted to mention that I saw one with my own eyes and couldn't believe it.
Well, you should believe it because it happens with some regularity. And as we've talked about before, there are people. I think there's general acceptance that there's some around. We haven't seen any evidence of reproduction yet and really can't put a handle on how many there are or where they are. But the number of sightings and the people who are pretty definitive about what they saw, like you are, simply can't be refuted anymore. So even though we used to poo-poo it, as you did, that's not happening anymore. And there are biologists getting together to discuss issues of cougar management at some point down the road in Wisconsin.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. You were lucky to make that sighting, Joan. Thank you. Margo in Glendale, it's your turn.
Hey.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I've got a toad problem. I had all kinds of toads in my yard. My bird bath has been a toad bath,
mm-hmm.
which is fine. But I went to Colorado this summer, came back mm-hmm. early August, and my toads are gone.
Mm-hmm.
I've got little tiny ones about fingernail size.
Mm-hmm.
The dryness?
Well, what happens with toads is that you see the adults in the mid to late spring when they move to whatever water they can find. It might be a water garden in someone's backyard, as it is in my case, or maybe even a bird bath or any source of water, because as amphibians, they have to go to water to breed and reproduce and lay eggs in the water. And then once that activity is over, the adults spread across the landscape, and if it's dry, even though they're amphibians, they're much more resistant to drying than most other frogs or members of that group. But they're not out in the bright sun. That would be detrimental even to a toad. So they become pretty secretive. And in my case, I don't see them except at night when they gather up at the base of the white garage door, taking advantage of all the bugs that are attracted to the sodium light on the end of the garage. But they're around. Now, what happens then is those long strings of eggs hatch, become little black tadpoles or toadpoles, if you prefer, and come around the 1st of August, as you described, all those little tadpoles metamorphose into little toadlets the size of your little fingernail, and they, in turn, leave the breeding pond. And, these have even made emergences like this when they're big and concentrated. Have even made the national news in years past when areas, sidewalks will be literally covered with these little toadlets and a yard. It looks like an unbelievable infestation, but it's just these little toads leaving the breeding pond and moving back to higher ground to grow up, and some, not all, but some become mature toads and start the whole thing over again the next spring.
Ah, that's cool. You know, thank you for calling, by the way, Margo. The toad issue reminded me again about water and the spring rains. And the spring rains were great for frogs and so forth, but did have apparently some detrimental impact on some of our birds.
Well, we talked about this a few months ago, Larry, and it was my opinion that, yes, I mean, there was certainly incredible devastation to human livelihoods, houses and crops and roads and assorted things like that. But in terms of the wildlife impact, it was still a relatively small chunk of the landscape impacted by inundation or actual flooding. And that has proven to be probably advantageous to a lot of amphibians. But it's now becoming, I think, more clear that I may have been a little premature and say, it's no big deal, because it appears that some of our bird populations that people are now starting to get concerned about because of upcoming hunting seasons, like the dove season that opened Monday morning, it appears that dove reproduction may have been depressed. Sightings of pheasants and pheasant broods have been few and far between, and there's now some concern that the wild pheasant population may have taken quite a hit. And I suspect there are probably other ground nesting birds, other bird populations that aren't perhaps as closely watched by a lot of people as pheasants and doves, for example, that probably also took a hit, as well as even some insects and other such things, and even some plants, where there was either inundation or just prolonged heavy rain and then cool conditions that's not good for ground nesting birds. So it's not been good.
All right. Georgia in Waupaca, it's your turn next. Hi, Georgia.
Well, hello. I'm calling to ask Scott Craven for any information he might have about a very interesting migration of spotted salamanders that was reported to me by a daughter who drives into Madison every morning from the north. Apparently for many days, maybe a whole week, every morning the road was covered mm-hmm. with spotted salamanders crossing from one side to the other. She said it was carnage, but the road got slippery. This is yeah. Highway 22 where it meets 51,
mm-hmm.
just above 60.
Mm-hmm.
And this migration was going on for days. It mm-hmm. started suddenly, and it stopped suddenly.
Mm-hmm.
She never saw them in the evening coming back. Always in the morning going into Madison.
Mm-hmm. You mean she was going into Madison, not the salamanders. Okay.
Salamanders were crossing the road.
Yes. Well, this is there have been other such observations. My colleague in the department, other extension fellow, had just told me on, I think when I talked to him on Monday, I think it was Saturday night, he lives on the west side of Madison, out by a managed waterfowl production area, wetland on Mineral Point Road called Shoveler Sink. And there's a road that goes by Shoveler Sink that's a notorious site for salamander migration. And he, too, reported that for a few nights, the salamanders were leaving the wetland and they're headed back into the uplands now, as the toads do. These are the salamanders that have either remained around the breeding pond or, more likely, the ones that have metamorphosed from larval salamanders from the spring egg laying. They're now mature and they're headed back into the uplands like the little toads. And his two daughters had a bucket with 89 big fat tiger salamanders, and they're tiger salamanders, by the way, not
spotted ones.
What's that?
She was telling us about it and said there were two kinds, and if they were one or the other.
Yeah, these are most likely tiger.
They were the spotted ones.
Right, they're most likely the tigers, and they look spotted, okay. So it doesn't matter. They're both in the same family and behave similarly, but the spotteds are a little more common further north. But anyway, they can be
in the morning too.
Yes, yeah. They moved under cover of humidity and darkness and relative safety at night. But the problem is a salamander is ill-equipped to handle road traffic, which
yes.
tends to go through the night, and they're not very fleet of foot. And in the time it takes a salamander to cross a road, like the old video game Frogger, where you tried to get a frog across the highway, a lot of them get squished. And David reported that the road out at Timber Lane was also just a carnage of dead
yeah.
salamanders. But the good news is that it appears to be such a large emergence, again, perhaps due to the water levels, just a really good year for them, that large numbers are making it. And people were putting up handwritten signs on the side of the road that said, you know, salamander crossing, slow down. And teams of neighbors in that particular setting even organized nightly bucket brigades. And they go along the water course side of the road, pick up the salamanders in buckets and move them to the other side of the road. So people are trying to intervene, but salamanders are still getting squished, but enough will make it that it appears to be a good year for salamanders.
Yeah. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call, Georgia. Patty in Stone Lake is up next. Hi, Patty.
Hi, what a great show.
Thank you.
We have, in the early 70s, we would hear whippoorwills at night, and now we haven't heard them for years and years. Are they still around?
Well, they're still around, but they don't seem to be nearly as common as they were. I think if you went to the Breeding Bird Survey, you'd find that whippoorwills, which are one of our neotropical migrants, have dropped off a bit in population. So your observation is correct. They're not nearly as common a night sound as they once were, but they are still around. I had one outside our cabin a couple weeks ago, and you know, while they're interesting to hear once or twice, if they set up shop outside your bedroom window and they can be pretty incessant with
yeah.
the calling, it can be a little annoying after a while.
Right, but I do miss them.
They were a very well-known night sound, and you could hear them from a long ways off, but they are less common than they once were.
Thank you very much.
Yep, thanks for calling. Bill in Milwaukee, we're on to you now. Hi, Bill.
Hi, the talk about the cougars have me thinking about another extirpated species. I've heard of wolverines in the Upper Peninsula. Is there any truth to this rumor? And I'll just listen on the radio. Bye.
There have been varying reports and sightings of wolverines in a variety of places, but there has been no effort to reintroduce such animals, and no one's really talking about it. And furthermore, we're a lot further from source populations from wolverines than we are from cougars. And as a short-legged member of the weasel or mustelid family, they're not as mobile across the landscape as a long-legged cougar that can cover and does cover hundreds and hundreds of miles. So my opinion is that there are that the wolverine sightings have been overrated and are more likely human artifacts. In other words, escapes from game farms, someone's attempt to release one. There are two that I know of in Wisconsin in probably the last 10 years, one down near Monroe and one on the ice in Beaver Dam Lake during the winter. Both were, in fact, wolverines, one photographed, one killed by a car, but both were tracked ultimately to game farms where they escaped. So I don't think we've got any wolverines running around. In fact, there was a big deal in the professional journals just in the last few months of documentation of a wolverine finding its way back into the mountains in California, where they had also been extirpated. So I'm pretty suspicious of wolverine sightings.
Christina in Wood City, your turn. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. I love to walk through the woods and go berry picking, and I'm concerned about bear, especially, say, a sow with young, and I'm hoping you can advise me about how to behave if I did, in fact, encounter a bear.
Well, it's obviously something that gets people thinking. A bear's a big animal. There's not a huge risk with black bears, but I'm looking here. There were actually a set of guidelines in this journal I'm holding in my hand, and I brought it for this very reason. Now, if I can only find the advice. This was a survey done of professional biologists from around the country who work with, here we are, how people should respond when encountering a large carnivore, including bears. And these were the opinions of wildlife professionals. And I want to find the summary here for you. The bottom line is, I don't think it's a huge concern, but it could be. If you were concerned, the first thing I'd do is get some bear pepper spray that hikers and so forth tend to carry in the West. It can be very effective, and that can certainly help you out. Generally speaking, a black bear is more concerned about getting out of your way than you are of theirs. Now, where is this here? Respondents disagree about whether a person should make eye contact with a bear. A slight majority said no, so eye contact seems to be equivocal. I just want to find here. Bear with me here, for Larry. Think of something to say. I'm trying to find this report because it seemed very suspicious to me. The first response was, let's see. If a black bear came into camp, most respondents said that a person should aggressively encourage the bear to leave. I wonder what that means. Aggressively encourage the bear to leave and to fight back against a bear that enters a tent, regardless of the species. Respondents unanimously agreed that bear pepper spray is effective in defending against a close encounter or attack. This is what drove me nuts. The respondents agreed that the most appropriate response when encountering a bear was to try and increase the distance between the person and the bear. Now, what kind of a statement is that? You know, that basically they're saying, you know, get away from the bear. And I guess that is reasonable advice. But I think I've also said that, you know, as you're trying to tactfully and gracefully put some distance between you and the bear, don't turn tail and run screaming through the blackberry bushes, but rather, you know, maintain a fairly high profile so the bear knows you're there and slowly back away. And then the pepper spray would help if things escalate beyond that. But I was surprised that the professionals were pretty well divided on coming up with some really good guidelines for what's a very good question in terms of what should I do.
Yeah. Thank you, Christina. Good luck. Sharon in Belmont, your turn. Hi, Sharon.
Hi. My husband and I have heard what we think is a bobcat twice, and I just wondered if any of them have been reported or seen in the Lafayette County, southern Lafayette County. We're below Belmont.
Yeah. Yes, there have been records and sightings and encounters and so forth down kind of along the western corridor of the state along the Mississippi River, where it tends to be kind of hilly in the driftless area and lots of woods and so forth. So I certainly wouldn't rule out the possibility that bobcats were getting down your way. Not commonly or in high densities, but certainly a possibility.
All right. Thanks, Sharon. Wendell in Prairie du Chien, on to you. Hi, Wendell.
Good morning. Thanks for the show, guys.
Sure.
Got a update from a buddy of mine setting up deer stands this morning. He called, and he couldn't believe the number of turkeys that he saw. and he said a lot of them were small, like only a foot tall.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounded like a late hatch, maybe adjustment from the flooding.
It could be a late hatch. I think some birds probably did re-nest if they lost their nests, and there have been lots of accounts of big broods of poults around. I did a wild turkey program up in Minocqua a week ago Monday night, and several of the people driving to the turkey lecture actually saw fairly large broods, one a hen with 11 poults that he described as only grouse-sized at best. So they're even later in the North Woods. But the good news is, since fall turkey season opens on Saturday the 13th, there seems to be lots of turkeys out there.
That's excellent. I was kind of worried with the wet conditions.
All right.
They're doing fine.
What about this? The aftermath of this turkey tag fiasco that happened, Scott?
Well, anybody who hunts turkeys knows about the disastrous results of the online ticket tag sales last March in the spring for spring permits. And the assurance now is that the system, the vendor, which is Central Bank of Missouri, has reached an agreement with the DNR that they guarantee that this computer disaster won't happen again. They've actually paid a $155,000 penalty, which is going to be in part used by the DNR to promote youth turkey hunting, do some other good things. But that does little, I think, to put aside some of the ill feeling that folks who either stood in line for hours or sat at a computer screen for a couple of hours had. So the assurance is that when the permits go on sale in 3 days on the 6th, leftover permits for the fall turkey hunting season, that this fiasco will not be repeated.
Adrian Weidevin joins us for a minute or two. Adrian, hello.
Hi, Scott and Larry. Hey. How are you doing today?
We're doing great. What have you got to add to us?
Well, I just wanted to update you on dog kills.
Excellent.
By wolves.
Thank you.
The actual statistic is 17 hounds, a total of 18 dogs that were killed so far this year.
Okay.
Last year, we actually had only 13, so last year wasn't as bad, but 2 years ago, we did have 25 dogs killed.
Okay.
And the vast majority of these are hounds in training and in hunting situations. In fact, I'm not aware of any bird hunting dogs that have been injured or killed by wolves in a bird hunting situation. And I myself hunt right in the Shawamigan Forest in the Klam Lake area with my English Setter, and I've never had any problems myself. So it's very minor risk to the bear hunters, but it is something of a concern for the bear hunters.
Good. Thanks for the
you.
Update, Adrian. Thanks for calling, and good luck with that grouse hunting this fall.
Yeah, I think it should be a good fall.
I hope so.
Thanks a lot for calling in, Adrian. Appreciate it. And Scott, thank you so much. Boy, the time flew by.
Time did. We had lots of good questions. It was great. Enjoy the early fall, everybody.
Yeah, enjoy that early fall. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. And as always, he'll be back on the first Wednesday of October, and we'll have an opportunity to talk with him. Maybe we'll bring some of those sounds and have a chance to listen to some more of those bird sounds and deal with that. Actually, Jim Packard brought in some owl sounds for us, and I wasn't able to work them in. But, Jim, thank you for doing that. Oh, boy, I'll tell you what, always lots of things that we could cover. Peter Green of InfoStar of Madison will be our guest on Monday's program. On tomorrow's program. Peter will be talking about, of course, personal computers and all the problems associated with them. So join us again tomorrow as well. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.